I'm not the only one, Mr. Neal is going to conduct your hearing for just so long. It's going to take him a minute to get all adjusted and all of those good things, but he will be conducting your hearing, sir.
Yes, sir.
And this is the suit.
Do you need a moment, sir? I think the names of the people in the boardroom that are here came back from this hearing. Okay. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Would you state your full name and ABC number for the record, please?
It's Miguel William Herrera. 077037.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Oregon Board of Indemnity Clemency this morning in reference to a program. I'm going to introduce the board members that will be conducting a hearing at this time. We have the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chairman, the Honorable Bill Rittenhouse, the Honorable Michael Johnson, my Honorable Mike Rudy Canonis, and my name is David Bell. I'll be the hearing lead. So, I'm going to go over some information, sir, and as we go through it, you can verify it if, and I'll, you know, check to make sure that it's accurate. But once we get done with that part of it, then we'll talk to you as the board. Get to know you a little better and see how things are going. And you'll have an opportunity to address the board as well as the opposition, Norfolk County Attorney's Office representative, and there's one or two other people here on the victim side. So, you're 49 years old this time, sir?
50.
50. Sometimes the paperwork that we get is produced before his birthday, and I don't fix that. All right, so you're serving a life sentence for first degree murder.
Yes, sir.
Which began June 30th, 1988, with a consecutive 10-year sentence for aggravated robbery and a 21-year sentence for kidnapping, which is consecutive to the robbery sentence. So you came before eligible to your next consecutive sentence, which would be the robbery, on June 30th. I have the wrong date there. So anyway, we'll do a second, I will. The right date before would have been June 30th, 2013. I'm sorry. And you were certified for this hearing, which is for 12 to your next consecutive sentence or after your discharge, on February 20th, 2018. You have been before the board 10 times, and you've been denied each time. So I'm going over a summary of the offense. And then we'll cover some more information about you and the time incarcerated. So on June 30th of 1988, you, your girlfriend, your father, and your two brothers, brothers Bill and mine, and drove to an isolated dirt road in the southwest Phoenix area in two vehicles. After the one car started overheating, while parked the two cars parallel to each other, we started drinking and listening to music. And about an hour later, a passing motorist reported that the vehicles were there, reported to the police, believing there had been an accident. Norfolk County Sheriff Deputy Vincent Marconette responded to the scene and asked all of you for your identification. Your father became belligerent, which led to a scuffle in which Deputy Marconette was wrestled to the ground and his gun was taken from his possession. the group, their group, RDO, they were going to shoot Deputy Marquinette. And we later admitted that you held the gun on Deputy Marquinette for 2 to 3 minutes as the victim was on the ground before you shot and killed Deputy Marquinette. So is that basically what happened, sir?
Yes, except for 2 items.
Okay, well, then again, a couple of minutes, we'll let you correct those items, okay? I just want to get the basic gist of what was going on out there. So, your criminal history, there was really not much at age 20 at the time of the offense. You had little programming. And you only had one ticket, which was in 2007, but it was dismissed. That's commendable, sir, to spend this much time in prison and not have any disciplinary problems in that. But at this time, I don't see much in the way of community or family support. Is there anyone here that may have not signed an offer that's in support of Mr. Rivera? No? Okay. So, Mr. Rivera, let's go back. First of all, I need a summary of the offense, and you said there was a couple of discrepancies. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about the offense and what happened and what was going on at that time? Go ahead.
Argue about who was going to do anything, and it all happened all at once. It didn't take more than a minute.
Okay. So tell us what was going on, what led up to it, you know, all that, and what happened when the officer got there.
We're drinking. We're drinking. The officer came, and he asked us for IDs. My dad became. And my brother, my older brother was,
who took the gun away from the officer when he was on the ground?
He wasn't on the ground.
Okay, well, who took the gun away from the officer?
I did.
Okay, he was standing up?
Yes.
Was he being held by your relatives, or was he they fighting, or what was going on when you took that gun?
We scuffled a bit, and then I got the gun, and then that was it.
So did you shoot him while he was standing up, or when he was on the ground?
I think he was on the ground.
Okay. Well, I know there were some other convictions and, you know, other parties that were there. Are all the rest of the people that were involved in that that were convicted, are they still in jail, or are they out, or what?
Well, my youngest brother is out. He's been out years already. And my father died, and my brother recently died last year.
So, I don't understand why you would participate like that if, you know, your father would have been drinking and got upset, and your brother had warrants or may have had warrants and got worried about that. But why would you shoot the officer when they're the ones that have the issues with it?
That's one of the questions I've been asking myself ever since. The people I was coming by to teach me and to guide me weren't doing so.
How old were you?
I was 18 at the time.
Okay. Did you go to school?
I only went to the 8th grade. Okay. I didn't graduate the 8th grade.
Were you working?
Yes, I was.
What kind of work were you doing?
I was working as a salesman at Checker Auto Parts.
Respectable work. Okay, so let's move on a little bit here. You did complete your GED since you came in?
Yes, I have, sir.
And you got some computer tech programs that you took, business tech?
Yes, I have, and I also sent you two letters, and one of them was I had two copies of certificates of what do you call those? Two associate degrees.
And you got two associate degrees for how?
Yes, sir.
What college?
In small business, and the other one was science. Technical science.
Okay, what school?
Eastern Arizona College.
Eastern Arizona College, okay. I just couldn't see that one a lot, and apparently they have some good programs that inmates can partake of. Good programs, especially when you're on yard that doesn't have a whole lot that DOC is offering.
So, yeah.
Your lease plan is it basically just talk about you want to live with your mother.
She lives alone, and I just wanted to take care of her before she passes away.
Okay. And is there nobody else that lives with her?
No, she lives alone.
Okay. Now, as far as placement goes, Department of Corrections required the halfway house for a period of time, but it also doesn't look like there would be any problem with, or shouldn't be much of a problem getting your mother's address approved. So what would you do for work, so you can have an income so you can take care of her?
I have my older brother that can help me find a job, and I can, there's a lot of things I can do, I'm just not certified to do them, you know. I did a little bit of plumbing, landscaping, that's one of the things that I took in here, is horticulture.
Well, see, taking horticulture classes could help you get a job at a plant nursery.
Yes.
And, I've got a granddaughter that went to work at one. She was just really thrilled, but she's got absolutely no education in it. So they're going to teach her. Yeah, so there's that, but that's a good future. Do you have any money on the roads or anything to...
Yes, I do. Okay. I've been gathering up from the little jobs that I have.
Okay. I mean, I realize you don't make a lot of money working in prison, but one of the things is that they usually will require some way, something to show that you got at least 2 months' worth of money saved up, or somebody that will vouch for the expenses to, you know, keep you going for the first couple of months so you have a chance to get a job or anything.
Yes.
So, you got that. So why don't you tell us about how you've changed since you've been in prison and you know, how you're a much better person now, and how you've changed, what you've done that would help qualify you for a return to the community.
Well, the most important thing is that I came to see the truth about how I was living. It was because of Christ. And it is the words that he shared with us that we should improve ourselves and love others and help others. And I've taken that to heart. And one of the things, in order to help others, you have to first better yourself. And that's what I did with all these programs that I've been taking. I'm still taking other programs, but it's not through DOC because I've pretty much fulfilled all those programs. And I'm going to continue to do that. In here or out there, I'm going to serve my Lord.
Okay, you can talk about, you know, trying to help others. You've been in quite a while, and apparently you've learned that, you know, living the way you're living isn't a good thing. Do you do anything to try to mentor the younger inmates as they come in, try to convince them that they need to change their ways so they don't come back?
Yes, I have.
What do you do?
I teach them and show them the truth about the way that life is out there and the life that that got them here. That we have to change our way of thinking. And when we change our way of thinking, we also have to change our way of our hearts. Because at times their hearts are so cold and hard, they gotta get softened again. And I use the Bible to help them do that.
So you do that in like an organized class, or inmates come to you, or you come to them, or you do it one-on-one?
They come to me, and I go to them, and I do it on one-on-one.
Okay.
Because I'm not seeking anything to be, you know, I do it out of my own heart.
Right, well, that's fine. Sometimes they organize classes. And the inmates are, you know, facilitators and things like that. And so what you're doing, usually we hear is more of a one-on-one. Do you think you've been successful with anybody?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Okay, that's good. Because you know what I'm saying, if you can save one life.
Yes, it does. Just, even if it's just one.
Okay. I'm going to see if my fellow board members have any questions. Mr. Canones.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Herrera?
Yes, sir.
My name is Luigi Canones. I'm one of the board members. I just have a question for you, or actually sort of a series of questions. How did you feel about the police in 1988?
Can you repeat that?
How did you feel about the police in 1988?
I don't know, really. I don't really know. Maybe it was because I was drinking. I don't know. I wish I could answer that.
How do you feel about the police now?
So what?
How do you feel about the police now? It's been 30 years.
I love them.
Why?
Because they're doing a job that is very risky. And they're doing good. And I wish I could change that, you know? I can be a part of that.
Thank you for your answer, Mr. Herrera. I think that's a question I would have liked to ask the last time you were before the board. And I kind of remember that year. I know there were two very veteran officers that were killed during that same year. It seemed under very similar circumstances. So I guess I wanted to know how you felt. Thank you, sir.
Another comment from the board? Just done. Okay, sir. There's no supporters here for you at this time, so I'm going to defer this to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office and the victim side. And after we hear from them, then I'll be back with you, okay?
Yes, sir.
And same as the last hearing, if you want to defer to other people, you know, other victims or representatives who want to speak first, that's fine. It's all up to you.
I would prefer to proceed that way, sir.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Jerry Glass. I first met Vernon Marquinette back in the early 1970s. I was a young man, not old enough to go into law enforcement. I worked for a Valley retail chain, and the company hired off-duty deputies to work security for us. And so that's where I met several deputies. And Vernon was one of the guys that was one of the real nice guys. I always came by and visited, chatted, laughed with people. He was a real down-to-earth person, you know. And a few years later, when I was old enough to go into law enforcement, I went to work for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and ultimately became a deputy in 1982. I retired from the Sheriff's Office in 2002 as a rank of sergeant. I never worked out in the same assignment with Vernon, but I worked several off-duty jobs with Vernon, and I considered him a friend. I remember the day Vernon got killed very well. I was working light patrol. It was my normal duty assignment. Vernon was working patrol down in District 2. I finished my shift up at the lake, and I was on my way home. And on light patrol, we had take-home vehicles. And as I'm coming home, on the radio, I heard of the shooting. And of course, you don't get out a whole lot of information on the radio. So I knew a deputy in District 2 had been shot. But they don't give out the deputy's name, obviously, and they don't give out the fact that he had deceased. So when I pulled in the driveway, I sit there for a while, listening to the radio, trying to contain as much information as I could. My wife could tell something was going on because of the way I stayed out in the park for a while. When I walked in, I'm sure she could tell by the look on my face. I told her a deputy had been shot. Didn't have a whole lot of other information on it as of yet. And about that time, my pager went off. And it was for me to call my lieutenant. I called my lieutenant. He told me it was Vernon Marquinette and told me that he had been murdered. At that time, they called all the lake patrol back on duty to go out and assist with the investigation, assist with attempting to locate these subjects. At that time, we had learned that Vern had contacted these individuals. But we also learned that when they, during the scuffle that Mr. Herrera refers to, one of the members of the party took Vern's radio away from him when Vern was trying to call for help and hit Vern over the head with the radio. Once they disarmed Vern, they made him kneel on the ground. And then he was executed by being shot in the head with his own gun. Vern was just a man trying to do his job, the job he was called to do, the job all of us do every day. In 1999, I was a sergeant in charge of auto theft and I was on a stakeout. I got shot in the face. I bring this up only because once I got out of the hospital, I saw how my family dealt with that situation. The trauma that my whole family went through because I was doing a job that I had swore to do, just like Vern was doing. A few months later, another deputy that I used to be partners with was shot. I wound up going to do the notification to his wife. And then, that's when I felt the horror that my family felt and the horror that Vern Marconette's family felt when those deputies knocked on the door and told them that their loved one had been shot. Luckily, I survived. Luckily, the deputy that I did the notification on survived. Vern didn't. That still affects every officer on the street. That still affects every police officer and their family anytime an officer is shot. Anytime an officer is shot in the line of duty, not only myself, but my family, Vern's family, every other officer out there that's been shot in the line of duty, feels that same horror all over again that they did the day that their loved one was taken. It's going to continue to happen. Alcohol does not make a person violent. Alcohol just merely reduces a person's inhibitions. If the person's violent, those inhibitions are going to come out. The alcohol doesn't make them violent. The person is violent before they start drinking. When a person shoots a police officer, they're not just shooting that person, they're attacking our society. They're attacking the laws that are put in place so that you and I can sleep safely at night. I ask that you deny his parole. Because we have to send a message to the criminal element out there that attack on society will not be tolerated. And I ask that you send a message to the officers that are out there risking their life every day, and to the families to kiss their loved ones goodbye at the beginning of the shift, that we not only have their back, but we have their families' backs also. And a cold-blooded murder of a police officer should not be tolerated. And I ask you to deny his parole. Thank you.
Any questions from anybody? Thank you.
The other individual that is here is not going to speak. Again, I'm Kirsten Valenzuela from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. I know that several of you have probably already heard this case before, but in case you don't recall from the last time, this individual and his father and his brother were all sentenced to death. That was their original punishment that the judge that presided over their trial and heard all of the evidence determined was appropriate. When this defendant's case made its way up to the Supreme Court, they decided that based on his alcohol usage, his poor family upbringing, the influence of his father, and low IQ is what it stated, which I'm kind of confused about since he just stated that he has two associate's degrees that he's earned while in custody. But based on that, they converted his death sentence to a sentence of life imprisonment, which was at that time under the statutes the 25 to life. So he was given, after they took off the death penalty, the judge that took over that he was given the 25 to life and then the two consecutive terms. And the facts of the case were played out in two different trials because the defendant and his brother were severed from the trial of his father. But his younger brother, Ruben, took a plea deal and was given 10 years in order to testify against his other two brothers. So Ruben was 15, Michael was 18, I believe William Jr. was 19, and William Sr. was obviously the father. And then Michael's girlfriend was there, Miss Cardenas. So the information that we obtained from Ruben and from Ms. Cardenas and from the defendant himself was that these cars, they all got the alcohol, as you indicated earlier, Your Honor, and they had stopped and were drinking in the desert. A car passing by thought that there had been an accident because of the way they were parked. So they asked Deputy Marquinette, they lived in that, and said, we think there's an accident. He went over there, and because William Jr. had a warrant from skipping his probation in Texas, he told Michael, as Deputy Marquinette was dealing with the father, I don't want to go back, I'm going to fight him. So as the Deputy Marquinette put William Sr. in the back of his car and had Reuben stand near the end of the car, Ms. Cardenas was sitting in the truck. He walks back over to William Jr. and Michael, and William Jr. says, I'm not giving you any ID, and that's when they start fighting. Dad is yelling, Reuben, let me out of the car. Reuben lets Dad out of the car, and Dad immediately goes over and joins the scuffle that has begun. And this was not just a tiny scuffle, it was a big scuffle. There was many footprints found all around Deputy Marquinette. He had dirt in his crotch area, in his buttocks area, in his knees. His glasses, his sunglasses were found 6 feet away from his body. At some point, William Jr. was able to get his radio away from him, and he threw it at his head, creating a severe laceration on his forehead. And Michael was able to get the gun away from Deputy Marquinette. And Michael, as Your Honor previously stated, admitted that he, while he had him down on the ground, decided after Dad and brother were yelling, shoot him, he had him down there for 2 to 3 minutes, and he decided to shoot him, and he put a bullet through his right eye. He had stippling on his face from how close Michael was when he shot him, and he had powder burns on his hands showing that he was trying to protect himself. And still Michael chose to pull that trigger. Reuben was at the back of the car looking out to see if backup was coming. But this information not only comes from Michael, but it came from Ms. Cardenas, who was looking for the registration of the truck that Deputy Marquinette had asked her for. She sat up and she saw Michael having Deputy Marquinette at gunpoint, and then she heard him pull the trigger, and she heard the other individual saying to shoot him. So this defendant has already been granted leniency and mercy from the Supreme Court in giving his death sentence down to a life sentence. But he knew that Deputy Marquinette was an officer. He was in full uniform. He chose to get his gun, and he chose to shoot him. They could have easily jumped in their cars, taken the deputy's gun and radio, and taken off, taken his keys, left him there. They could have escaped, and they chose not to. Michael instead chose to shoot him in the head. So I think that this board of executive clemency should not grant him release. He should remain and serve out the rest of his sentence based on the gravity of this crime and the choices that he made that day. Thank you.
Any questions from the board? No questions. Okay, Mr. Harrand.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I believe that we will be getting toward the end of your hearing at this time. Before the board goes into discussion to make a determination, we might give you the opportunity to make a final statement. Tell us anything else you think might be important to our decision. We just ask that you don't repeat the information we've already covered, okay?
I understand the feelings that they have. And I just like I wrote in the letters that I sent to the parole board, I spoke my heart in them. And like I said, on the letter, here or out there, I'm going to serve the Lord. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Could the board be going into discussion to make a determination? We'll be talking amongst ourselves. You may think we're addressing you, but we won't be. But we ask you to stay on the phone, but remain silent, and I'll get back with you once we've made a decision. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the board is now in discussion. This is definitely
a very tragic case for many reasons. And I fully appreciate the gravity of this type of crime as to what it does to the victims and how far out the chain goes with victims involved. Not only the family, the friends, and especially the family of law enforcement. But when you're on the other side of that, I personally can't get my mind wrapped around how anything like this could ever happen. I don't think that way. I wasn't raised that way. I didn't learn anything like that in school, so I just can't wrap my mind around any kind of justification for this. But the I realize that at this point it's kind of a little bit shaky because of the I think it's lack of belief that he's going to get out. I don't think he's made much of a plan, but that's one of the big things we look at. But in my mind on this case, what I look at is the totality of this offense. And when you get the facts that were supported in trial and in appeal, and they're based on more than one witness, they were involved people, but they were also witnesses to it, and everybody's testimony, everything that was put together originally. This is an extremely heinous situation, and it wasn't a scuffle where there was an accident on the job. It wasn't somebody driving wrong and running over an officer that's on a traffic stop. It wasn't in any way, shape, or form an accidental act. It was, may not have been premeditated, but it was a conscious act at the time. It was incurred by other people, and it was committed in a very heinous manner. And when I look at the totality of this, I don't see, in my mind, the qualifications for any kind of a release at this time. But I'd like to hear discussion from my fellow board members. Ms. Rittenhouse?
Thank you, Mr. Moore. I just want to point out for the record that this parole hearing is really for full to a consecutive sentence. So it would not be to release anyway, but it
could be actual discharge.
It could be actual discharge, but there are two consecutive sentences still on the table. So just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Mr. Canales?
Yes, I do want to say that I appreciate that Mr. Herrera has developed himself considerably in the Department of Corrections, but I independently believe the courts granted sufficient leniency when Mr. Herrera's sentence was commuted from death to life imprisonment, and I think it's unfortunate that it was a year before natural life was an option. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Wright?
Well, since I've been here several times, I feel the same way that I felt all of each time. He has not shown that he's ready to move to his next consecutive sentence, therefore I'm not in favor.
Thank you, sir.
That's right.
Okay. Okay, so based on our discussion and the totality of the situation, I'm going to move to deny Mr. Michael Herrera, ADC number 077037, deny for the next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. And with a 1 year set off.
Second.
Agree. And the reasons for denial: citizen violent offense, loss of human life, a series of grievous events, trauma to the victim. Victim harassment because of the fight and the obvious defensive moves by the victim. Okay. I'm going to put poor little news point on the fact that the only thing the fact is it's a little bit of cement. And very annoying to know about where community support from. And is there anything else anybody would like? Okay, Mr. Herrera, did you run out of the scene?
Yes.
Okay, you know the reasons?
Yes.
Okay, we do wish you the best of luck, and we'd like to see you keep moving forward with your progress there, and this will end your hearing. Can we put CO3 back in the phone, please?
All right.